you know, get a sense that public administration is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it needs, the field needs just good people who want to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. You're like, no offense to education, mm-hmm. but it can be way too theoretical in textbook.
True.
This is not textbook.
True, yeah.
I don't reference my textbooks.
Uh-huh. That helps to hear. I'll make sure.
Sorry.
No, that's important to hear, yeah. Would you want to tell me a little bit about Immuniminder?
You know, I get as much from my Civil War metaphors as I do from textbooks.
Really? How did you pick up Civil War metaphors?
I get metaphors from everything.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, some of this is just about making connections. Mm-hmm. You know, you read something. Mm-hmm. I love reading history and I love reading biography. This is a total aside.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to pause this?
No.
Because this is interesting.
No. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's reading something, hearing something mm-hmm. that you say, I get it. It mm-hmm. makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I do read a lot about the Civil War, or I have read a lot about the Civil War, and you know, I remember the passage where when General Lee became general of the Army mm-hmm. of Northern mm-hmm. Virginia, taken over from General Johnson, mm-hmm. he was called early in his career with the Confederate Army, you know, he was called Granny Lee, the King of Spades, mm-hmm. because he dug. And people saw
what?
He dug trenches.
He dug trenches. Uh-huh.
Fortifications. Mm-hmm. And people saw him as being very, very defensive minded.
Not offensive enough.
Uh-huh. Just the opposite.
Uh-huh.
He realized that his army was had finite resources. Mm-hmm. Now I'm putting this in my words.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, an army was both offensive, defensive.
Mm-hmm.
To meet the defensive needs, you had to allocate a certain amount of men.
Mm-hmm.
If he could reduce that
mm-hmm.
by employing the available technology,
uh-huh.
ditches,
uh-huh.
abattis,
uh-huh.
you know, the wood stakes,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
if he could decrease the number of manual resources that he needed for his defensive lines, and he could use technology for that, he could use more of his resources for offense.
Uh-huh.
And I was reading that, I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, I was thinking about that in relation mm-hmm. to work, and then, again, Steve Seifertz and I were talking. In some of our programs, like temporary assistance is a good example,
mm-hmm.
we make no bones about it. We want to change behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want people to work. We mm-hmm. want people who are not working to work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do everything we can to help them.
Mm-hmm.
In other programs, like food stamps, mm-hmm. daycare, like energy assistance, there's no pretense about changing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We're much more like an insurance company, mm-hmm. claims adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
We take these are people who are working, they have fixed incomes. Our job is to make benefits available as efficiently as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to dedicate staff resources. If I want to change behavior, mm-hmm. it takes a relationship.
Uh-huh.
It takes humans interacting with humans mm-hmm. in engagement.
Mm-hmm.
I need staff for that.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to do that, if I want to increase my emphasis there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this is a very conservative county, which I mm-hmm. very much agree with and mm-hmm. loathe to add staff,
mm-hmm.
if I want to increase my resources in an area where I want to really change behavior, I need to become more efficient in areas where I have more of a claims adjuster eligibility mm-hmm. function. So how can I use, just like General Lee, how can I use available technology
mm-hmm.
to decrease the amount of resources
mm-hmm.
I need there so I can deploy them elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just reading that, and I was thinking, that's what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly what I want to do. And we do stuff like that.
Yeah. So is that sort of what, I mean, is that part of what you did with the welfare work? Is that the strategy?
That's been ongoing since.
Uh-huh.
We've made a lot of strides
mm-hmm.
in developing technology. And Steve,
mm-hmm.
you know, very mm-hmm. much agrees with this. We've made a lot of strides in developing our technological infrastructure so that we can be more efficient
mm-hmm.
on this whole
mm-hmm.
Claims processing
mm-hmm.
side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, like you stealing ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was calling my credit card company
uh-huh.
once, and, uh-huh. you know, I got some buddy, you know, down south or in India. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, call center, why can't we do that? Why can't we do that? And, you know, then I read Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat, and he's talking about deconstructing work, and that, you know, this makes sense. This makes perfect sense. And so right now we are, we're in the final step of planning. All we need is to change our telephone system, and we're going to develop a call center for food stamps. So that, and this is going to be perfect, just like your credit card company. You know, workers now have so many cases, they don't know this. The clients. They don't need to know the clients. The case maintenance workers are responsible both for case maintenance, which is you're receiving food stamps, you've moved, you've reported a change of income, you've just given birth and you're adding someone to the case. Something that just needs to be changed on the case. And then there's the recertification or renewal function, which is a which is an annual process. Workers are so busy that, you know, clients are calling to report changes. Workers are involved in other stuff. You know, telephone tag is enormous. You can't get through. Communication problems. Things get backed up. What we want to do is develop the call center. Have we've developed the just like in credit card companies. Person you're calling doesn't know you from anybody, but they have electronic access to your case record. They've got some sort of narrative screen to access all the pertinent information. That's what we're going to have. So we're going to have a small group of individuals who will just be on the phone responding to case maintenance issues. They don't know anything about the case other than what they have on the computer in front of them. And then we'll have, you know, another group of individuals who will be responsible only for renewals and subsequent determinant of eligibility. I can complete those functions, I think, with fewer people than are currently deployed.
Great. And then what are you going to do with the extra?
You redeploy. I mean, either redeploy into areas where you need them or when there's vacancies. You know, part of this is returning to the taxpayers, too. Taxpayers expect us to be more efficient. And the budget office expects us to be more efficient.
Great.
So it's all that kind of stuff. You know, it's, it's making connections. It's more fun to use other examples than use textbooks.
Well, I think that's very interesting. I would like to work that in somehow, the Civil War metaphor. I think that was very instructive.
I got metaphors for everything.
You do. Well, if there are any more you want to share, that was really a really good one. Do you have metaphor for the Muniminder?
I'll have to think about that one.
Or do you want to sort of give me the over? Or would it be better if I talk with who's it?
Steve Morgan.
Would it be better just talk to him about that?
I can give you a 2-minute overview if you have time.
Sure. You'll have as much time as you have.
No, I've got time.
But I also wanted to give you, you know, free rein to talk about anything that you wanted that you thought might be interesting for students.
You know, the Muniminder is it was developed by a company out of Chemung County called Salient, and they actually developed this software for the private industry, for the bottling industry. And you know, this is, you know, going to your initial point about entrepreneurship. The president of the company, the owner of this company, had, you know, Chemung is pretty small. People, I think, tend to know each other there. Had heard, had been talking to the county executive who was talking about the Medicaid program, the woeful lack of information that Medicaid has to manage the program. And so he asked, how can my system help? You know, and I'm sure he saw that as a good public service and a you know, opportunity for a new market. And so he dedicated his own staff resources to modifying this Muniminder system, which really was kind of looking at inventory and process and adapting it to the Medicaid system. You know, Medicaid is the national health insurance program for the poor. It is far and away the largest program we operate. There are largest and most expensive. There are 60,000 Medicaid recipients in Onondaga County, so about one in every seven County residents receive Medicaid.
Wow.
The total cost is about $550 million. The cost to local taxpayers through property tax, sales tax, is about $90 million. It's far and away the largest item in the county budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we spent the vast majority of time talking about welfare, which is, you know, mm-hmm. I think probably the most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, welfare represents 7% of our budget, and Medicaid represents 70. In Medicaid, there has been, it is truly astounding
mm-hmm.
how this program has been operated without any meaningful data.
Hmm.
Counties have had no analytical abilities to look at anything with respect to Medicaid. How services, products are being used, who's using them, you know, the frequency of utilization, the cost of utilization, you know, potential issues of overutilization, etc.
Mm-hmm.
No meaningful information to help look at, you know, again, utilization, disease management, cost control, anything.
Mm-hmm.
The state made, for the first time, the state made information available to counties through something they called the data warehouse. And it is enormous. It's just every bit of information on recipients. You know, when somebody applies, you know, they're giving information on their you know, household income, resources, etc. So all that kind of demographic information, all the information on utilization, you know, who's using services, what providers are providing services, the cost, frequency of use,
mm-hmm.
all that information is now available.
Mm-hmm.
But the state just kind of dropped it on counties saying, here's the information that's available.
Mm-hmm.
No one had a clue how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just,
mm-hmm.
no one had a clue how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just unused. And one of our tech guys, he actually tried to, he wrote a query,
mm-hmm.
and he started the program in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and by the end of the day, it was still running.
Uh-huh.
It was, because there were just billions uh-huh. of bits of information,
uh-huh.
and he couldn't figure out a manageable way of mm-hmm. of breaking down the data.
Uh-huh.
And that's what MuniMiner does.
Uh-huh.
They really, really, really smart technical people
mm-hmm.
have figured out a way to kind of narrow the you know, analytical fields so that one can query data in your county more efficiently
mm-hmm.
than we had been able to.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, for the first time, we can start looking at things like how, you know, who's using services, what services are they using,
mm-hmm.
You know, look at just pretty much any question.
Mm-hmm.
By no means is this a perfect system. And please don't say that. No, keep that on. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are, it's still complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires, you know, some of the questions that we have, mm-hmm. you know, they're still refining it and improving it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's given us more information than before. And it's getting better all the time.
Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I was attracted to the TANF thing was it seemed like there was opportunity to be innovative. Whereas, from my understanding, which could be totally off of Medicaid and food stamps, there's very little leeway to change anything. But
yeah.
You're saying that there is leeway to change, at least administratively, how things are done? Is it?
Yeah. You know, our role in Medicaid, the county role in Medicaid in New York State was to determine eligibility and pay a quarter of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the state was responsible for everything else, setting rates, determining providers, you know, developing utilization thresholds, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
Counties had no role.
Mm-hmm.
We've a couple of things that we've done in the past, requiring state permission, has been involved with utilization. You know, we began offering, mandating certain populations to participate in managed care. We developed a demonstration with the state in relation to managed care for substance abusers, which was now a state model. It's very good.
What was that? Substance?
It's a managed care model for substance abusers. We, you know, again, I had gone to a conference, and I heard somebody from another county. They actually looked at some utilization information on substance abuse and utilization of inpatient treatment, which is the most expensive kind of treatment. And they had so many instances of individuals who are, you know, multiple users of inpatient treatment. You know, some examples, you don't want to base everything on examples, but some examples were the person being discharged from an inpatient program at 10 in the morning and re-enrolling at 3 in the afternoon. No check on whether, on the effectiveness of that model. You know, it's kind of axiomatic in the alcoholism world that most treatment fails, and that means somebody has to, you know, reach their, you know, particular bottom, wherever that is. But no one questioned the model. And so we actually did some work and kind of looked at our own, I forget how we did this, we were working with the mental health department, and we were, we looked at some information on utilization, and we saw similar patterns of usage. Small numbers of individuals, repeated use of high-cost inpatient treatment. And so we started asking, is that the only way to do it? You know, maybe there's another model out there. You know, then you started asking the question, well, why, what's the origin of, like, the 28-day, 30-day treatment? You know, inpatient treatment. And, you know, it's one of those, the kind of the founder of it was a guy who, you know, was a substance abuser, and it kind of took him 28 days to, you know, to deal with it. And so he kind of developed a model around his own experience, which is now the norm in the system.
Yeah.
But things change.
It's interesting.
But then you develop a whole infrastructure around, you know, that model, you know, that product line. So working with the mental health department, we put together a project. And one of the problems with the inpatient treatment is that when somebody leaves, there's not necessarily great follow-up. And so for the, you know, for the 28, 30 days, an inpatient, the person's dealing with the issues, they go back to the same pressures, same environment, same community, same pressures. They might not be working, you know, and relapse is typical. So we said, what if we could interrupt that cycle? Instead of people going to inpatient, really, really provide good outpatient case management. And case management is a way overused term, but really help people deal with their life as it is in the community. And, you know, combination of AA, outpatient therapy, getting a job, dealing with the boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever, kids. To make a long story short, the mental health department, we started something, got state permission, offered on a voluntary basis. The mental health department studied this. Every measure that you wanted to see moved in the right direction. There was less use of the participants. And we recognized it was selective. People could participate or not participate. There was less using, less hospitalization, more employment, less use of emergency rooms, less Medicaid expenses, more individual satisfaction. Everything you wanted to move was moving in the right direction. These folks wanted to get better, they just hadn't been able to figure out how. So, you know, and that was a kind of an instance of, you know, A, innovation, but, you know, problem driving it, use of data to, you know, to look at and then to evaluate the effectiveness of an intervention. But Medicaid has been really slow in developing good management information to look at anything. So you know, managed care, we began when this came along. We started looking at, you know, we decided, you know, and maybe this gets way too technical than necessary, but the state began capping local costs in Medicaid.
Meaning you can't spend more than a certain amount on a procedure?
No. In the traditional system in New York State, you know, the feds pay roughly 50%. State pays 25%, counties pay 25%. Mm-hmm. Costs go up, counties just pay, you know, 25% on the on the gross. Counties were revolting, you know, arguing that, you know, they couldn't keep up with their property tax rate, because in some counties the 25% local costs exceeded the whole property tax levy. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So they're arguing for some relief. The state finally agreed that it would cap local costs. It would set a base, and then every year counties would pay that plus roughly 3%. And then anything above that 3%, the state would pick up. Okay. So if the state changed policies, if it decided to expand the program, costs, you know, really increase, it was going to be the state that bore the brunt of it.
Not the federal.
Not the federal. The federal too.
Federal. So if the cap is at $100, the county will pay 25% of that 100, but if it's 125, they're only going to pay 3% of that 25.
Yes.
And then the state...
Well, our cost is $90 million this year.
Okay.
If we were just to pay a 25%, our cost might have been... Here, let me go back. Last year, our cost was about $87 million. We pay about 3% more. We pay that plus 3%. So it's going to be $90 million this year. If we had paid the 25%, it would probably be about $94 million.
Okay.
The state and federal are paying this.
Okay.
You know, the county argument was, look, it's the state that's determining the eligibility standards, it's determining the procedures, it's moving costs from other systems to Medicaid to capture the federal reimbursement, the county should be held harmless. So if they want to change eligibility, fine, they pay for it. And they have to figure out how to do this.
Right.
But our belief was that, you know, we had a chance to come in. If county's costs actually were below this index cap, you'd pay the lesser amount. Plus, like every system that is not managed, there's overuse. There's inefficiencies. There's lack of effectiveness. There's fraud. There's waste. So part of the Muni Minder was, the intended Muni Minder was to give us a better set of information so that we could look at patterns of service utilization to see if there were opportunities for more effective healthcare delivery or more cost containment through preventing fraud or misuse. You know, some medical services have value that can be market, that can be traded on the street. Prescription drugs, narcotic drugs, durable medical equipment are examples.
So people who actually need those things or have a prescription for those things would actually trade them on the streets.
So,
for something else.
Money.
For money. All right.
So
I've heard of formula, child formula being traded. But,
When we were looking at this whole issue, we sat down with the managed care companies because, you know, in managed care, they bear the brunt of inefficiency and misuse. You know, so it's the plan itself. So they have developed more institutionalized utilization review cost containment procedures. And we sat down with one plan, and it was fascinating. They did. They came up, they gave us a slideshow. It was very, very helpful. In a funny series of slides, they showed us an example out of New York City, and it was a guy named Nelson, mm-hmm. who had a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It was the Washington Heights neighborhood, you know, Upper East Side. And Nelson recruited people on Medicaid to feign illnesses and conditions for the purpose of getting medication. Mm-hmm. The things that were in popular, you know, kind of mm-hmm. popular, frequent usage. Mm-hmm. Not the narcotics, but mm-hmm. the, you know, I don't take medication, so I don't mm-hmm. even know what they are, but, you know, mm-hmm. the Lipitors and all that kind of stuff.
All right, okay. Mm-hmm.
So people would, and Nelson would buy them. Mm-hmm. So people would go to the doctor and say they had a whatever, mm-hmm. and Nelson collected all these, mm-hmm. and he'd just buy these drugs. And when the police raided Nelson, mm-hmm. think of a room like this. He had mm-hmm. a room in this area of New York City. Mm-hmm. And there were card tables. Mm-hmm. He had bags, huge bags uh-huh. of purple pills and red pills and green pills. Uh-huh. He would just collect them all and sell them back to the pharmacies.
Really? Oh, my gosh.
It was an unbelievable scam.
Yeah.
Not only was it a scam because... Uh-huh. You know, taxpayers are paying
right.
unnecessarily yeah. for medication that was never used,
right.
but it was unhealthy. I yeah. mean, this was dangerous.
Yeah. yeah.
Because
yeah.
the reason that you get medication in the amber
uh-huh.
Containers is to cut out the sunlight because mm-hmm. These things deteriorate over time. Mm-hmm. Nelson didn't care about that.
Uh-huh.
So he just had them in these bags, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so the pharmacies would buy them back.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Who knows if they were effective or not.
Yeah.
You know, and then the pharmacies Goodness. Would resell them.
Yeah.
So it was a total yeah. scam.
Oh, my gosh. So they picked up on...
So this was a big police operation. That's uh-huh. why he felt free. This guy was arrested.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we looked at... When we used this MuniMinder, one of our questions was, well, look, you know, drugs are a serious issue in this community, in any community. Who's using... Who are the high users of narcotic drugs?
Mm-hmm.
And we did a query and uh-huh. identified... We worked with the health department to look at this, and the health department commissioner said, some of this is scary.
Uh-huh.
If this is happening,
uh-huh.
this is scary.
Uh-huh.
And so we called in the 100 top users mm-hmm. of narcotic drugs just to get more information.
Yeah.
And we saw some cases that we... One, the first guy that we called, he admitted right off the top that... He sold them.
Mm-hmm.
He sold them.
Hmm.
He would just go to different doctors, get prescriptions mm-hmm. for the mm-hmm. either the same thing or you know same families, mm-hmm. and he would sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a law enforcement issue.
Uh-huh.
You know, in other examples, the number of individuals just didn't respond, and they uh-huh. called to close cases.
Uh-huh.
Others were. We talked with the state, and they were then in, they were going to multiple docs,
mm-hmm.
and docs do not coordinate
mm-hmm.
their, you know, the prescriptions.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were going to multiple docs, getting the same things or the same family,
uh-huh.
and there was no good state pickup to mm-hmm. identify mm-hmm. these cases,
mm-hmm.
and so they were, you know, either selling or using cocktails,
right?
You know, to magnify the effects of the.
Huh.
The narcotics.
Goodness.
Uh-huh. So we got the state to agree uh-huh. that these individuals, who they determined through mm-hmm. an administrative review, mm-hmm. were not using medical services appropriately, mm-hmm. would go into a managed care plan,
mm-hmm.
so that mm-hmm. they had to go to a sole provider for mm-hmm. all their medication.
Gotcha.
You know, we also looked at individuals who are frequent users of emergency rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those. Kind of one of my pet issues
mm-hmm.
because I know mm-hmm. some people because they don't have access to primary care,
mm-hmm.
you know there used to be someone here in the living in the county who longtime homeless guy who mm-hmm. normally you know during the day he would spend on the steam grate over at the or the heating grate over the steam station.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And whenever he got cold or needed some food, he would call Rural Metro, the ambulance company. Mm-hmm. They'd pick him up. Mm-hmm. They're required by law to take him to an emergency room.
Uh-huh.
And the emergency room would take him. He had no medical issues. He just needed to, you know,
get out of the cold,
get a sandwich, get cleaned up.
Uh-huh.
That I get, but, you know, taxpayers were paying, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, so he can go to the emergency room for nothing.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't interested in any dealing with things. So we identified, you know, the top users of emergency room services, and, you know, again, tried to fashion an intervention to address why they're going. And again, you know, there was every reason in the world, but some of the response was enrolling the individuals in managed care who were not previously, so that their care could be, managed, so that they might not need such frequent utilization. I think the top user was 50 or 70 times in a year.
Wow, that's a lot. You keep talking about managed care. You're talking about like consumer directed, the CDPAP program.
No.
So that's totally different. Do we have that here?
Consumer directed?
Yeah.
I started.
Oh, I kind of want to hear about that later. But so what do you mean by managed care? Is this a private managed care? Is this like Medicaid C?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, historically, managed care is fee-for-service.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a doc, and a doc bills, you know, bills Medicaid. And, you know, any service you get is, you know, you find on your own, either through referral or on your own. In the late 90s, the state got permission from the feds to pursue managed care. So, just like commercial managed care, an individual who participates had a choice of participating with, in our county, one of four managed care plans. We would pay the plan a premium, and that plan is then responsible for rendering all care necessary.
Private managed care plans.
Yeah, the local plans are Excellus, Blue Cross, Fidelis out of New York City, United, and Total Care. Total Care is the local, it's kind of a homegrown, connected with the Syracuse Community Health Center.
Gotcha.
So we pay them a premium, and then they're responsible for everything. There are carve-outs on different services, but you get the model.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Very interesting.
You know, not only is that designed to be, you know, cost containment, but again, when I started in social services, not necessarily in this job, but in social services, one of the real problems in managed care is that the fee structure was so low for fee-for-service and the paperwork so high that people did not have access to primary care. They really didn't have access to specialty care. You know, having a Medicaid card was not a ticket to health care. People couldn't see docs. You know, now they don't have a Medicaid card. They have a Total Care card. They have an Excellus card. Their card might look the same as yours or mine. And so, you know, docs, you know, they're indistinguishable.
Well, that's
there's much greater access to the health care services than fee-for-service allowed.
Well, that's interesting. I have a student who the other, I'm not sure how she's paying tuition or what's going on, but she has Medicaid, she said, and she wanted to go to a provider, but they wouldn't accept, you know, the Medicaid reimbursement, but she offered to pay the difference, and there was some...
You can't
do that. Yeah, there's some rule or something like that, she was saying. So she's going to write a paper on that. So what kind of rule is that? Is that a Medicaid rule? Is that a state rule?
I would imagine it's federal.
Federal, okay.
They just don't want recipients to be exploited.
Yeah.
You know, for providers to accept this.
Accept more.
And then ding them for more.
Gotcha.
So it's kind of like...
So it's a protective measure, but it also has a back sort of a problem to it. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. I didn't want to get us on a tangent. It's just
you know, it's kind of like in the private insurance.
Yeah.
You know, if the doc accepts the Blue Cross rate.
Right.
They accept the Blue Cross rate and your copay.
Right.
You know, they're not saying Blue Cross rate plus we're going to ding you for for the difference between our usual and customary and Blue Cross.
Right.
So it is a protective device.
Right. Oh, interesting. Although dentists seem to have no problem with that. Do you? You know, they'll accept and then they'll say, well, this is what's not covered. Interesting. So, oh, I want to hear about the CD, the consumer directed. Did you just started that, or is that how's that?
No, I was involved in that back in the 80s when it started. That was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Pirro, I was fairly new in social services, and the administrator for the person I report. No, let's see. I worked for Commissioner Stone. And the person he reported to in the county exec's office was Kathy Rosito. Kathy called me one day and said, and this is a DSS at that time was responsible for a part of the home care casework function. It's no longer responsible for that, but at the time it was. So that was under my jurisdiction. So Kathy called me one day and said, look, can you do us a favor? We're getting a lot of complaints from younger disabled people in the community who are complaining about the whole home care system. Can you talk to people and see what's going on and see if there's any, you know, what the county can do? So I said, sure. So I did. And it was fascinating. It was a real good learning experience for me. You know, and, you know, I talked with a lot of people, you know, and, you know, recognize that when home care was designed, it really was designed for an older population to keep them out of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
With medical advances, a lot more younger individuals who were experiencing either congenital or, you know, situations or disabilities because of injury, like spinal cord injuries. You know, they were, you know, technology was doing a wonderful job to keep them alive.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to spend their life in institutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they still want to be engaged in the community.
Mm-hmm.
They had, you know, long, you know, fruitful lives ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were stuck in a home care system that didn't work. And part of the reason it didn't work is because of the very transient nature of the providers. You know, people come and go.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to maintain a stable, permanent workforce. You know, I had too many people tell me, you know, on holidays, on weekends, you know, that the aide can't come at the time that I need them to put me to bed, so you know they come at 4 in the afternoon. I have to go to bed at 4.
Oh my gosh.
The next aide, you know, if the aide shows up the next morning, she might be late. It's not until 11 o'clock. You try to keep your bowels between 4 and 11.
Yeah,
you know, it's just really tough issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, one young man was telling me about the hundreds. He counted hundreds of different people who had been involved in his life,
mm-hmm.
tending to the most personal aspects of his
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
bodily functions,
mm-hmm.
which he found very embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that I heard, you know, kind of an underlying message was, we want control in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I get that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be self-directing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're stuck in a system that didn't work for them.
Mm-hmm.
The system wasn't designed for them. The system was designed for itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was designed, you know, initially for an older population. As the public realized that there were more and more of these younger individuals needing home care services, a number of states, as I found, developed their own, like, social home care programs to deal just with this,
mm-hmm.
this issue. But New York didn't. New York, because New York likes to tap into Medicaid to get the, you know, 75% discount,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
decided to run this through a medical model.
Mm-hmm.
So, in order to get this discount, it developed a home care system for the younger disabled that was inflexible, it was medically oriented. Inflexible, I mean, it was home care. You really can't use AIDS to go out and engage in the community. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So I got it. You know, mm-hmm. it's because, you know, of a financial decision, we then typically younger disabled, mm-hmm. not exclusively,
mm-hmm.
you know, individuals with real legitimate, you know, home care, personal mm-hmm. care needs mm-hmm. are stuck in a system that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, we kind of asked ourselves, well, what would work?
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with the idea of this, you know, consumer-directed or self-directed home care program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was what I wanted to do, which we couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my goal was, I think the role of the system is to be the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think that's an appropriate role, to determine the, like, level and amount of care that the individual needs,
mm-hmm.
translate that to a dollar figure, and then basically say to the individual, here's the money that is due you.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the amount of money that you're eligible for.
Mm-hmm.
Spend it as you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you're meeting your home care needs, as long as you're meeting your personal care needs,
mm-hmm.
spend it as you will.
Mm-hmm.
You want to buy the services of OneAid mm-hmm. at a high price
mm-hmm.
for less hours. Mm-hmm. If you can get if you can find somebody, you know, it treats
mm-hmm.
you as a private pay.
Mm-hmm.
You make the best deal you can.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't work, come back into our system.
Mm-hmm.
But you're treated as a total private pay,
mm-hmm.
and you can. This is free market. You can mm-hmm. do as you will.
Mm-hmm.
And all we'll do is we'll be the gatekeeper, determine the initial allocation, and mm-hmm. and then how you doing?
Mm-hmm.
It's your life.
Hmm.
That didn't work.
That didn't work. They didn't.
That was a little bit too out of.
The state wouldn't go for that.
No. But what they agreed to mm-hmm. was we would be the gatekeeper. We would determine the level of care and the amount of care, then we had to work with an agency who would then kind of be the consumer-directed agency. So if we said to you, you're eligible for 20 hours a week,
mm-hmm.
then the agency would pay a rate, a set rate. The consumer would be responsible to identify one more caregiver to provide the care, make the arrangements, and direct the care that's provided. But the administration would all come through this agency.
So they would have to pick somebody who worked for that agency?
No.
No, they could pick anybody.
And then the person would then be technically an employee of that agency. So you pick your neighbor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, a good example, you know, I was talking to somebody I know whose neighbor was, they live out, you know, in one of the rural areas. And, you know, it's probably 20 miles from right here in Central City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the vast majority of the staff come from Central City.
Mm-hmm.
And they use buses to get to assignments.
Ah.
How are you going to get to Vegas? How are you going to get to Pompey?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, this person was really stuck without adequate care.
Mm-hmm.
Consumer director was a lifesaver. Lifesaver.
Mm-hmm.
Young, you know, younger man who was in an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he needed a lot of help to, you know, to continue his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the regular system could not respond.
Uh-huh.
It was no error. It was just kind of the whole structure of
right.
it.
Right, right.
But, you know, the consumer-directed program allowed him to hire someone he knew
mm-hmm.
who could then, you know, would be hired by, you know, Enable or Arise
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he would direct the care that he was going to get.
Hmm. And that was somebody who lived near him or something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Is it a perfect program? No. None of our programs are. But
mm-hmm.
it is. It provides a lot more opportunity
mm-hmm.
for, you know, good, flexible service delivery than, you know, than the old system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it's in a great escape valve, because the home care system is so stressed
mm-hmm.
with retaining an adequate cadre of aides. It's tough work. It's tough work, and when the economy is decent and there are, you know, decent paying jobs out there that people can gravitate toward, a lot move to them and not personal care. So this really does provide, you know, a very good opportunity for us to provide good care to the people who are the traditional system. If we didn't have this, traditional system would not be able to keep up.
Right. Is it cheaper for anybody? Or is it, what do you mean wouldn't be able to keep up? I'm not sure.
They just can't retain the aides.
Can't retain the aides. But this, because people pick and vet them themselves, they're more likely to be somebody.
Yeah, and you know, the person they might pick, that person doesn't want to be a general care provider. You know, if I go work for XYZ agency, they're going to assign me to this person, this person, this person, you know, and I've got a, you know, I'm on staff, so I do the hours they need.
Right.
If I'm working for you, we come to some agreement. I'm only working for you. You don't need me any longer. You know, I'm not beholden to the agency. I might be able to do this on my spare time.
It could be a second job, things like that.
And
it's people they trust, usually.
Yeah. I can do it on the way to work and help you coming home.
Well, that's really neat. And that's still running.
It's 200 some recipients now.
Wow. Very interesting. Wow, there are only people who do multiple case studies here. This is like, there's a bunch. But very interesting. Great. Well, this has been very helpful to me. I appreciate this. I've learned quite a bit. And any questions you have for me?
No. So, what class? What class do you teach?
I teach related to this. I teach research methods that came up earlier, but social welfare, which is an overview of different social welfare programs.
That's fun.
Yeah, very, very fun.
How long have you been at Le Moyne?
This is my fifth year.
Oh, really?
Fifth year, yeah.
You're a kid, though.
Well, I'm 31. I'm not really a kid, you know, but well, maybe I'm a kid. That's good. I appreciate it now, because now that my joints ache a little bit, you know.
Just wait.
But human services caseload management is one where these case studies are going to be put in. They learn relational database construction, and they do some direct service skills, kind of like social work-ish skills. But also, the idea is to infuse it with entrepreneurial thinking and things like this, case studies about what is life like in a managerial sort of, upper level managerial situation. But then there's a third course, which is program evaluation and policy analysis, which they get into making logic models, familiar with sort of federal funding and things like that, budgeting, simple pre-test, post-test evaluation strategies, things like that. So there's sort of a sequence of three courses that I teach that relate to this. I could see one case study about, you know, the importance of learning how to build and create and use databases, right, in the database course at least, talking about the things that you've identified with using MuniMinder, you know, identifying high uses of emergency rooms and different various high uses of various drugs and things like that. I think that would be a very instructive case study for, you know, the utility of what they're doing, how it's used. And then, with the TANF, I think I actually could see that fitting into either any of the three classes. And then the consumer I see possibility for actually multiple case studies. But so that's what I teach right now.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. There's a possibility to learn all the time, and this has been a great morning.
Your duties are is it three classes a semester?
Three a semester.
Are you on semester or quarter?
Semester.
Okay.
So, although
you have to do research.
Yeah. We do a lot of research. The expectation is about, well, it varies depending on who you talk to, right? This is a friend of mine wrote her dissertation on what is expected for tenure, people have all these, you know, ideas that nobody really knows. And nobody can tell you for sure because the committee changes every semester. And so you don't know who you really don't have a boss. You don't know who they are until the semester before. I've been told about, you know, seven publications before tenure, that type of thing. So it's The market is not great for academics, so they can ratchet up the requirements easily, which not a problem. I've done quite a bit of research. But,
What do you do research on?
A variety of things. Recent papers have been on senior student affairs officers, sort of administrators at universities who do student life. Mm-hmm. And so looking at issues of sort of pay and compensation for them. There's a Zogby poll, have you heard about the Contemporary Catholic Trends Zogby poll, which they, through an agreement with John Zogby in Utica, we poll Catholics nationally twice a year. And so we did one on social welfare programs, looking to see, you're probably familiar with Gösta Espeng Anderson's three welfare state models, comparing, say, the U.S. to the Scandinavian countries, which were generally more social democratic, and maybe Germany, more corporatist, whereas we're a more liberal welfare state. Sort of comparing U.S. Catholic perspectives on welfare policies. Some stuff on, did a little on TANF implementation, how people were, how caseworkers were interested in, following the sort of performance measures and things like that, how that helped to restructure what they did and things like that. So a lot of this was a little bit familiar, not a lot of it, but enough to understand what you were talking about. So the kind of neat thing is you can do pretty much anything. We're working on a new paper on because it's a Catholic school, and because we have that agreement, we get data on Catholics. And so we're looking at how Catholics feel about different leadership roles, comparing how Catholics feel about how comfortable they are with a woman as a CEO versus their supervisor versus their president versus a senator versus a pope versus a priest. That yielded some very interesting data that we're unpacking right now. Yeah, it's a very 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 happy with a women. Most is in the public sector. Most in the private sector, CEO and boss. I suspect because a lot of people have experience with that. Little less with public official, and then down to like 50% for religious leadership. It was very interesting.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah. So it was very interesting work on it. So we're still, using control variables.
People think that role is more paternal.
There's a very interesting Mary effect. Are you familiar with Catholicism at all? You understand basic Catholicism a little bit. Mary has sort of a higher regard in Catholicism than other mainline Protestant religions, and we're not trying to understand why people who are devoted to Mary or practice devotions to Mary have are less supportive of female leadership positions in the church. Surprising, isn't it? But we have a bunch of theories as to why. We just have to think we might have to do a follow-up survey to figure that out. But on
you
surface
have to read
level,
the Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code. Do you think that has an insight into?
I didn't read.
I did actually read the Da Vinci Code. I was, whenever there's a lot of discussion, I try to read it. But because on surface level, you'd think, well, if somebody really has a strong devotion to Mary, you'd think they might see her as a leadership position, but would that translate to being comfortable with priest and pope leadership? But we were surprised it didn't. And second glance, you might think, well, maybe that's because people who are devoted to Mary are more conservative, right? But you control for conservatism, and it's still there. You control for orthodoxy. We have an orthodoxy scale, which is, there are things on that tend to get sort of the conservative right Catholic voters. The Catholic voters are kind of split, right? There's ones who are more pro-social justice and ones that are more pro, we call them family values, but things such as gay marriage and stem cell and, things like that. And the interesting thing is, even if you control for that orthodoxy, there's still that effect. Which is just interesting. So that's one thing that I'm wrestling with now, trying to, and of course that's statistical data. You don't actually get to talk to people and say, why did you answer this way? What else? We did research. Currently researching with somebody who's doing we're studying learning communities, college campuses.
Yeah.
And this guy studying effects of retention on learning communities in community colleges versus 4-year colleges, and So you're familiar sort of with what learning communities do and what they are, and we're finding that, surprisingly, there is a huge retention effect for four-year colleges, but for two-year community colleges, no. No, and so we're you know, we thought it would be kind of a universal thing. And we're trying to, right now, tease out what's going on. We think maybe with a larger package of things. Right now we're going to go into sort of actually tease out the different types of learning communities and see what they... this is sort of a national sample, but it was a cluster sample of 18 different institutions, so a bunch of 4-year and a bunch of 2 years across the country. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
There's just, there's no end to what you can sort of look into.
Do you feel under a lot of pressure to do research?
Well, when you first start, you're not sure you can handle everything, especially with the teaching load. We have 3 versus, say, Syracuse, they have 2. They might have a 2-2, or if they buy out time, they'll get a 2-1. We'll have a 3-3, or if we buy out time, we'll have a 2-3. Although, actually, we usually tend to teach 2 sections of the same thing, so it's almost like 2 courses.
Okay.
And so you're wondering if you can do it, and you feel pressure, but then you get hooked on, and it's just, it's like today, I was looking forward to this, like, for 2 weeks, you get addicted, you're curious. You learn new things, and so it's not really any pressure anymore. It's just for fun. And
you've been there 5 years?
Yeah, this is my 5th year.
When does tenure come up?
6th.
Oh, really?
6 years. This is kind of a weird thing, right? Your 6-year job interview? then you... And if you don't get tenure, you get 1 more year, and then you have to leave.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so, and every year we see a few people leave, and
you'd be okay?
Well, I'd be okay. You can't tell. It's political. There's a committee. Well, I have enough publications where I can go elsewhere if I'm not okay. Problem is, you don't want to uproot your family.
Yeah.
There's a lot of research on, how the sort of feminist research on how women who've gone into academia fare. And there was a big generation, sort of the first generation of where women really sort of entered academia, and right when women were entering all sorts of career professions, and their delay had to delay childbearing, or not have childbearing, and so there was a very interesting, because really, if you have a child in those first 6 years, in biological clock, I mean, if I wait till tenure, you're getting really close to 35. And that causes stuff, tension between first wave and second wave. Now today women want to do it all, and the idea of a superwoman, and a lot of ideas of, career and family and things like that. It's
That's nuts.
It is nuts. It is really nuts. And so many people move around. I know people who have written famous books, and they haven't gotten tenure, and they're bouncing around.
Yeah.
You don't know where they are. And these are like brilliant people. It's just like, you don't want to think about it too much. It's, but yeah, I like it. I think at Lemoyne, it's a good group of faculty who work together. It's kind of like everybody's sort of a jack of all trades in a sense. They're willing to work together. And a thing that I've started this a Center for Applied Regional and Urban Regional and Urban Applied Research. Oh yeah, I'll give you this if you ever have it. But it's the idea is to kind of, Ernest Boyer was a thinker. It was funded by the Carnegie Foundation that really, are you familiar? Have you heard maybe his name? Talking about scholarship in action. Actually, Nancy Cantor has one variation of that. You've probably heard of, there's posters all around SU, scholarship in action. But this is something that we started a few years ago to develop. And the idea is to encourage faculty working with community members in a way that's different from the traditional town and gown difference, where people from universities usually come down off the hill, research, use it for their own purposes, and then, move on. And there isn't really always a tangible benefit to people in the community. So the idea here is that you start with the place you start the research is in a community need with community members, and you work together on designing it, carrying it out, and that it has 2 functions. One is to produce something of use to the community, and another is for the faculty member to try to fit it into their research and publication agenda. It's a hard sell in academies across the country. I've been talking about, I don't know if you know Pam Heinz at SU. We have counterparts in different places. It's kind of like you were talking about, trying to figure out, gee, how do you sell this? Because it's teaching. Mostly, actually, even at Lemoyne, research, teaching, and service. And the easiest, that's how you get promoted, that's how you get tenure. The easiest stamp to get punched is your service, right? There's a million communities, there's a million committees, a million community activities you can be involved in. And so people really don't have a need for that. They need to get their research up and running. It's a lot easier to come up with your own research agenda and then ask people versus to develop something together. Sure. And I've been involved with a whole bunch of projects, you know, a whole bunch for 5 years, working with, you know, Syracuse Housing Authority and Syracuse Municipal Choice Program. I don't know if you know that, but which is now sort of disbanded. It's just a bunch of sort of startup projects trying to develop research that helps them. And then, but none of it has actually ended up in publications for me. So what I'm trying to do is sort of lead by example. But we have a good group of faculty who are interested in serving the community, and many are tenured, and so they're not too worried about, you know, does it end up in publication. But it's a hard sell for the junior faculty, and that's my job to sell it. You know, not to sell it, but to make sure that the model works. And but you know, there are a bunch of exciting opportunities. You know, the Northside Collaborative. You know, sort of connected with 40 Below, Dominic Robinson. Yeah. You know, that you've been involved working together quite a bit, collecting oral histories on the north side, trying to help with community revitalization. You know, the other thing is the agenda keeps changing, right? When there's a lot of people involved, what the final product is that's most useful keeps changing. So it's you really have to get into it and enjoy it, which I do. So,
that's great.
I don't mean to go on, but you asked. Any other? This is just really, really great. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you're busy, but you know the other parts of this.
This is really left field stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our role in child welfare is very prescribed. You know, mm-hmm. it's investigating cases of maltreatment. And, you know, dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, every 2 hours we'll get a call on average.
Really?
Yeah. 5,000 a year alleging maltreatment. And mm-hmm. about a third of those cases will make a determination that there was, that the child's health or safety was compromised by their mm-hmm. caregiver. And what happens then, you know, just depends on the seriousness of it and the ability to engage the, you know, the caregiver. So, you know, our role is just that. You know, a lot of the programs that we work with, you know, to participate, it's some eligibility criteria.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's either based on, you know, finances, you know, some sort of means test, or a kind of behavioral
mm-hmm.
Eligibility. You know, you've maltreated your kid, therefore, you know, you're eligible for, sometimes you're mandated to participate mm-hmm. in different services. But what about everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the issue in the community is there are so many kids, so many families that are struggling, mm-hmm. that have issues that, you know, the problems haven't risen to the level where they've come to the attention of the system. You know, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
But, you know, the dropout rate in the school system is enormous. You know, like I said before, like 20% of the welfare recipients have high school. High school complete 12 years
mm-hmm.
In our county. Terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going to go?
Mm-hmm.
What is this?
Mm-hmm.
What is this kid's life going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
What's the community going to look like? What's our nation going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're talking about so many kids who are entering their adulthood
mm-hmm.
totally ill prepared,
mm-hmm.
there's just so many learning issues.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that fact. Everybody's on drugs. I'm not talking about illegal drugs. Everybody's on some sort of drug to deal with a learning issue. Certainly mm-hmm. in our mm-hmm. child welfare program.
Like
Adderall, you know, attention deficit, mm-hmm. hyperactivity.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's on something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and our interventions are limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we either have talk therapy or we have chemical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical therapy is my term. It's not the term in the community.
Mm-hmm.
But we either intervene by mm-hmm. trying to talk with someone about mm-hmm. their issues
mm-hmm.
or a drug is used to address some underlying issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have kind of a mechanistic view of our behavior. You
mm-hmm.
know, our thoughts, our mm-hmm. behavior, they don't exist outside of us.
Right.
You know, we're a product of our
right.
of physics. We're a product of chemistry.
Uh-huh.
if something's going wrong with us, uh-huh. it's because we're either not put together well, or mm-hmm. some chemicals aren't flowing, or mm-hmm. there's some malfunction, mm-hmm. you know, in the way things, neurons are triggered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've done, if you looked at any of the research on like ADD, the ADD brain is different from mm-hmm. a quote-unquote normal brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coincidentally enough, there was an article in, did you get Newsweek?
No, but was this like 2 days ago?
Yeah.
Okay. I
read the article.
Read
on
it somewhere.
Mm-hmm. What the Beatles did for science.
Oh, no, this is not what I read. Oh, what, the Beatles?
Yeah.
No, no, I didn't read that.
It's the one with the mm-hmm. 1968 on the cover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when one thinks, it's the cortex mm-hmm. that's involved, and brain waves of a certain frequency are generated.
Mm-hmm.
In ADD, that frontal lobe pretty much shuts down, mm-hmm. and it's a different part of the brain that comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point of drugs. Mm-hmm. It's to stimulate, you know, the frontal lobe.
Mm-hmm.
The article is about meditation. And mm-hmm. how meditation does the same thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, without chemicals.
Hmm.
There's other interventions uh-huh. that kind of are on the fringe that uh-huh. that haven't been fully accepted yet
mm-hmm.
that I think have some promise
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
to address some of these issues.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of based on the idea that the brain is plastic and can be remolded,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is true. Mm-hmm, I mean, that's mm-hmm. You know, if there are lesions on the brain for mm-hmm. whatever reason, mm-hmm. The brain can develop new pathways.
Right.
So there are some interventions which really try to change the way the brain is organized,
mm-hmm.
so that it can engage in critical thinking, more present time critical thinking, more mm-hmm. effectively, without the use of chemicals.
Hmm.
Honestly, I buy it. I think
mm-hmm.
specifically it's called neurofeedback therapy. Go on Google and
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can even send you some articles.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be very interesting.
I want to see if it works.
Yeah.
It worked for my daughter.
Really? My wife's a special ed teacher.
Yeah, she
talks about this a lot.
Really?
We talk about this a lot, yeah.
Our daughter has ADD,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
and
mm-hmm.
she's good. She's in college now.
Mm-hmm.
Good enough in high school,
mm-hmm.
smart enough so she could compensate.
Mm-hmm.
But her performance never matched her potential.
Mm-hmm.
Did wonderful on the standardized tests,
mm-hmm.
and didn't do her homework.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the old Pac-Man game.
Yep.
And all he's doing is monitoring your brainwaves.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pay attention, the Pac-Man game is running,
mm-hmm.
and the machine is beeping.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like operant conditioning,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
operant learning. You're just mm-hmm. you're being rewarded for paying attention.
Uh-huh.
And you start daydreaming, and the machine shuts off.
The game shuts off.
The game shuts off.
Huh.
So you're rewarded for paying attention.
Uh-huh.
And over a certain number of sessions, the theory is you can develop,
mm-hmm.
you can change your physiology. You can develop new neural pathways
mm-hmm.
so that you can, on your own, concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time in her life, she's doing it.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Immediately, uh-huh. immediately
mm-hmm.
after starting this,
mm-hmm.
she said, I can sleep better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm less reactive.
Huh.
You know, both of which are real characteristic.
Yeah.
Kind of a disorganized brain. Her handwriting changed.
Really?
Became a lot clearer.
Uh-huh.
And for the first time, she's at school, and she's saying, I can sit through classes that bore me, and I can pay attention.
Huh. Well, that's very interesting.
And I'm thinking, you know,
yeah.
some of the studies, uh-huh. that I'll send it to you, just for,
yeah.
the hell of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any neurological kind of based issues,
right.
like
right.
ADD, post-traumatic stress,
right.
even addictions.
Right.
So many of our kids have post-traumatic stress-related issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, they've lived in tough
right.
environments.
Right.
They've dealt with stuff that you and I haven't
right.
even thought about and considered. Mm-hmm. And they're experiencing elements of, you know, post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
Our interventions are weak. You know, talk therapy, I'm not sure talk therapy works well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, I don't know about chemicals. You know, it's something in our tool bag that we use and we use a lot because we don't have anything else. I'm not sure we know what's going to happen 20, 30 years down the road with kids who have had a lifetime of chemical interventions. I'm not pleased with that. I want to try this.
So you're thinking of running sort of a pilot and comparing some sort of a basically a program evaluation of whether or not this works, measuring benchmarks.
Yes.
Well, that's exciting. I think we definitely have, you know, well, I'm interested in the program evaluation aspect of it, but there are people in the psych department, I think, who would also be interested in study similar things, helping out. You know, as if you know, if you're thinking of it as along the lines of a sort of something that can be a collaborative project, and I'm pretty sure people at SU that I have run into in the psych department might be interested as well. You know, so I think there could be a sort of a large group of people. Or working group that would be interested in sort of helping to design and or what you know and measure. Is that what you're thinking?
Almost? If we, I asked the guy who did this with my daughter to come and talk with our child welfare staff, some supervisors and administrators, and they loved it. He said, "We want to do this. We want to do this."
Yeah.
So the ball's in my court. I got to get with him and talk about this more. But if we did this, you know, even though we don't bat an eye when we think about chemicals, you know, signing off on chemicals for kids, there's something that's kind of spooky about attaching sensors to the brain. Even though it's not like you're getting an electric jolt, it's not like this is totally passive, you know. It's just like going to the doc and getting, you know, EKG. You know, it's just monitoring your heart. So there's nothing intrusive about this. There's just something weird. And so, and because it's so different, I want to be connected with people who can answer the question, does this make sense? Not from a health perspective, because I don't think there's anything. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing bad that can happen. But is this effective? Can this help?
It's very helpful to have outside people coming to do that. Which actually, that's a big part of what we've been doing lately. You know, somebody gets a grant, needs an external evaluator to do that. I'm interested in that. I think, you know, we haven't really talked about neurofeedback, my wife and I, but she is always talking about matters of ADD and ADHD. And I think
I'll send you these.
Please be interesting.
Comment on that. I'm not convinced. And, you know, we work with a psychiatrist group, and our child welfare director talked with them about this, and they dismissed it. This is just, you know, it's just placebo effect. You know, they can't. The comment was, you can't point to the part of the brain that's been changed. Yeah, but you can't do that with chemicals either. And you know, half the time when chemicals are prescribed, you don't know if they're working other than subjective. You know, what the person's saying or what the family's saying in terms of observing behavior afterwards. And, you know, no one can point to how the chemical balance of the brain has changed. It's just, it's all based on kind of self-reporting.
So you don't need to if the behavior changes. You know, if you've got comparative data, you've got, you know, program evaluation that says, yeah, this group did, you know, the pressure then is on other people to replicate it. Prove it wrong.
And I don't care if it's placebo effect or
anything. The idea of placebo, right? They're not talking about a selection bias of who's doing this versus who's not.
They're saying that because the person thinks that they should be getting better, they get better.
Well, if that statistically significantly holds up and keeps working, why can't you use that? Why can't you use a placebo as a treatment? That's it. See, but they also have, you know, a vested interest in, you know. This would be very interesting. Yeah, I've worked with some rough kids. I worked for a little while in an orphanage, and not in the U.S., obviously, but I would be very, very interested in that substantively as well. Yeah, please send me the information.
I will.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently NASA does this with its astronauts.
Really?
Pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they have ADD.
Right.
But, you know, I get this. In a high-stress situation,
mm-hmm.
I can feel my brain shut down.
Yeah.
I can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a high-stress situation, if this part of your brain is shutting down and another part is taking over,
uh-huh.
and you can't focus, you can't stay present time, that can't happen in a pressure situation.
Right.
So if this is designed to,
right.
you know, help
right.
stay focused.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a legitimate thing to try. The U.S. military has for a while used video games to train people on firing, you know,
yeah.
to sort of overcome the hesitancy to fire at
yeah.
another human being. And somebody's using something similar to this approach. It might even be called the same thing, to help with drug addicts returning to their you know, where they, as you mentioned earlier, to, you know, you return to your same neighborhood, you have all the same things that sort of set you off, the triggers,
yeah.
right? To deal with triggers.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely something legitimate to try as a, you know, I don't think anybody should be sort of challenging that as an approach, a therapeutic approach. But does it work is the issue, and that would be very interesting to test. Do you think you'd have the ability to run a pilot to sort of fund a certain group? The other big thing that people really, and this came up with, somebody in the school district, I won't say which one, wanted to run a program evaluation. Does this work? Random assignment is a big political issue. If you really want to know if something works, you really got to randomly assign. If you've got 50 spots and you got 100 people, you can only give it to 50 people anyway. But it can be politically problematic to randomly select which 50. I don't know if that would be an issue
yes.
for this. That would be an issue. Yeah, that's always a problem with sort of proving something works. You know, there are other things you can do. You can basically just collect a lot of other factors and use them as control variables, and you know, then you get your regression and things like that. And it becomes the problem with that is when you're talking to policymakers, it becomes more convoluted, right? It's very clear to say this group had a higher rate than this, and we've controlled for that by randomness. You know, the numbers are very easy to compare. I'm sure this is something you're familiar with, too, but if you're showing, like, a policymaker, well, this is a logistic regression where you've done an interaction effect with it, and people, intuitively, it doesn't always make as much. It's not as convincing. See what I'm saying? So it's something to think about.
No, that's an issue. That's why I was... But what we could do is just look at before and after.
But that being said, police departments across the country have they wanted to know whether in domestic violence cases, pulling somebody in for a night of jail, counseling, or just pulling them and letting them go made a difference. And they randomly selected which of the three responses they would do on domestic violence call. You know what I'm saying? So it's been done. You know, it all depends on yeah. Oh, that's something that you would have to decide. Yeah.
And, I mean, if we did this and we said it worked, to tell you the truth, I don't have to justify it to anybody.
Right.
You know, we just have to justify it to ourselves
right,
whether we
right.
want to continue this.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Yeah, well, I strongly believe in evaluating as you go.
But I just...
Yeah.
The science behind this makes sense to me, frankly. I'm surprised that I'm even saying that, because I tend to be kind of skeptical about mm-hmm. this stuff. It sounds a little bit too new agey to me.
Uh-huh.
But I believe this, mm-hmm. and my daughter has changed.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
she hasn't done drugs.
Yeah.
She didn't want to do Adderall and all that
yeah.
stuff. But, you know, she went to other, you know, therapists and did some talk
mm-hmm.
stuff. And
mm-hmm.
That was never helpful in the long run.
Yeah, yeah.
But this, something mm-hmm. has changed about her.
Mm-hmm.
It has really changed.
Yeah.
Weird. And there's a case study that I'll send
mm-hmm.
you that
mm-hmm.
From this guy. It was sent with the permission of this kid's mother. And it's a fascinating read.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that information would be helpful for getting other people involved. You know, in the psych department. They're always doing... doing stuff. Not quite this, but along those lines. I think they'd be very interested. Very nice people. Very.
We don't know anything about the brain yet.
No. I remember a college course on cognition, and black box.
So I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But read simple as it is. Read that article in Newsweek about the Beatles. Mm-hmm. It's just talking about how they introduced meditation. Meditation is very effective in many instances.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought you were actually referring, when you first brought it up, to another article, a new research that just came out about ADD, I think. They were studying brain development, and this was through, scanning. And they noticed that I think it was mostly boys with ADHD, don't quote me on this at all, but they noticed that the development took longer. And that was one example of how they explained people growing out of it, as does happen, but also it suggested that there is really a biological. Some people have claimed that ADHD and all that is not really a physiological thing. You've heard, and so anyway, what they were touting was that it said there's definitely a biological link to this.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, some people doubt it.
Oh.
So there you are. So you're confirmed in that belief, at least. But that was what they were pointing out, that's what I thought you were referring to, usually. But. Well, this has been great. I sit here all day for you.
My daughter has it. My girl has it.